Hello, I'm Michael Sheriffs, and you're with Creative Instinct on RN, RAN the Web. And today we look at how two events 11 years ago drove a wedge between Australia's political sphere and the country's artists, writers and intellectuals, leaving our civil society with some serious unanswered moral and ethical questions.
Captain Arne Rinnan of the MV Tampa, owned by Norway's Wilhelmsen Lines, would not have been thinking about Australia's raging immigration debate when he rescued 424 people from a leaky tub off our northwest coast last night.
We will decide who comes to this country and the circumstances in which they come.
The situation in which the government's orders to take the refugees away may be no more than a legal bluff. At the moment, despite statements from Canberra, Captain Rinnan says he is still waiting for instructions from the federal government.
We heard a big bang, and then we saw smoke coming out, and everybody started running out, and we saw the plane on the other side of the building, and there was smoke everywhere, and people are jumping out the windows. Over there, they're jumping out the windows, I guess, because they're trying to see them.
Freedom itself was attacked this morning by a faceless coward. And freedom will be defended. Make no mistake, the United States will hunt down and punish those responsible.
On the 24th of August 2001, the Norwegian ship MV Tampa sailed innocently into Australia's already furious immigration debate. Just over 2 weeks later, and the attacks of 9/11 in America raised the temperature of the debate to boiling point, and the Australian social landscape started to heave. The consequences of all that's happened since have fuelled a lively conversation between two Australian intellectuals, artist and performer David Pledger, and academic and cultural theorist Professor Nikos Papastiadis. And today I'll be speaking to them about how each has responded in their work to the dynamics of refugees, border crossings and ambient fear. Nikos Papastergiadis has recently written a book called Cosmopolitanism and Culture, where he seeks to understand exactly what those two events of Tampa and 9/11 did to our civil society.
At the time, I was, like many people, trying to figure out what it meant and what are the consequences and how the politics of fear was being played out and the way in which fear was being dispersed into every dimension of our everyday life and how it produced what I call an ambient notion of fear. And while at first I set out to sort of confront this idea of fear, what I quickly realised is that everybody who's tried to speak against this politics of fear from a so-called normative perspective, that is from the position of reason, was effectively being marginalised and displaced further and further from the debates. Of course, we'll remember John Howard's activation of the politics of fear and how quickly he could sideline so-called enlightened figures, people from his own party like Malcolm Fraser, advocates of refugee rights like Julian Burnside, all sorts of international experts who came out to speak in favour of this or that position in terms of the health, welfare and political well-being of people. And the more rational the contribution to the debate, the less impact it seemed to have. And I quickly realised this was a competition over the affects, our emotions, our capacities to imagine a sphere of politics. And so I thought, in a way, I will not find inspiration towards the way out of this by looking into the realm of logic or reasoned debate. And the only people who I thought were finding a way out of this were artists, because they were aware of the consequences in all its rational implications, but they were also deeply committed to work through an imaginary sphere and to work with our ambivalent emotions of fear and hope and rework a way that addressed both our fear rather than saying our fear is purely irrational, therefore we must come forth and do the right thing for X or Y, or not be so suspicious because we need to be more virtuous. What artists, and David's a great example of this, were committed to was to sort of working with the materiality of people's minds and hearts and their bodies. And in that way, I felt there was hope rather than a constant battle over the very diminishing role of reasoned debate within the civic sphere.
Well, in the title of your book, you use the word cosmopolitanism, which isn't a word that we're all that familiar with here. We call ourselves multicultural. I'm just wondering if multiculturalism and cosmopolitanism are synonymous.
I think the history of the two terms can be connected in so that they do share something in common, but the application of the two terms in Australia in particular diverges. There's distinct pathways in which we've understood the word multiculturalism. I think in the origins of the word multiculturalism, there was an underlying cosmopolitan vision in the early 70s. All the founding figures of multiculturalism in Australia had a worldview that was bigger than managing their specific minorities. They advocated for rights for communities like the Jewish community, the Greek, Italian community, but they were also, whether it's George Papadopoulos from the Greek community or Walter Lippmann from the Jewish community, they also had a vision that was wider than that, a much more broader humanitarian, cosmopolitan vision, and what Walter Lippmann called an empathy for interaction with others. Now, that capacity for empathy slowly got marginalized as the policy of multiculturalism got directed more and more towards instrumental goals, fulfilling this service or enabling that kind of form of community cohesion or generating an expectation that this was going to contribute to the productivity of the nation, make us more competitive, make us more cohesive, and so on and so forth. So, in essence, multiculturalism became a managerial policy. Cosmopolitanism, in its essence, is about living not just with other people, but with the universe as a whole. Of course, it has this ethical obligation to finding a connection to other people and other cultures, but it, in its classical origin and its manifestation in a whole sphere of artistic endeavors as well ever since, there is the idea that you are part of something greater than the human race. You are in the universe itself. And so, as an ideal, cosmopolitanism includes literally everything. As a policy, multiculturalism has effectively, since the 70s, been reduced to smaller and smaller deals.
David, you spent quite a long time living in Brussels, living in Europe, observing the sort of dynamics of cross-cultural dialogue and interaction. Somebody said to me once that the problem with Australia is that we don't share physical borders with other countries. So we've never had to negotiate those cross-cultural sensitivities. We have an internal cross-cultural issue with Indigenous Australia and we've messed that up completely. Is that part of the problem? Is that why we can't seem to become a truly cosmopolitan country?
I think geography is really central to the social imaginary for Australians. I'm not sure how many Australians actually think of themselves as living on an island continent, but that is our reality, and that shapes our thinking, our perception about ourselves, about our neighbours, and about people outside of the island that we live on. We are, as a country, unique. And one of the things that we often don't understand is why we are unique, because we refer so much to everywhere else. I would say that most Australians would benefit greatly from travelling in their own country a lot more than they actually do. Then they will understand what you can actually take from the European experience. The fact that we don't have borders is so strong in the way that we construct a version of ourselves and really how we understand notions of fear. Because when Nikos is talking about the politics of the last 12 years, the way in which fear was wedged into the Australian psyche was made possible not just because of the strategies of the government of the day. It was because it is latent.
Mm.
It's actually sitting there, and it was made active in the agenda of a government that was very adamantly neoliberal. So for us as a society to understand where we've come from as a result of that agenda being played out on us, we first have to understand that it was always there.
I mean, it requires an active engagement and an active curiosity on a lot part of a lot of people. I mean, what you talked about the Howard era and the One Nation tendency to sort of almost utter incantations which revived these dormant prejudices, these dormant phrasings that were embedded deep below our critical radar. Just talk a bit about the fact that we are a very depoliticised and a very passive populace. We don't engage. You know, all of these ideas require people to put in a bit of work. We don't like doing that.
Well, first of all, it's hard to sort of get our own bearings in the world. Everybody does. It's hard for everybody. And we often do look for deficits and surpluses. And maybe, as David is suggesting, rather than saying, how do we stack up against, or in what ways are we separate from and unique to, it's important to sort of see what the dynamics that actually form us as a people in relation to the rest, not as an in competition with. Do we have an equivalent number of cosmopolitan points, or does our multiculturalism make us, you know, inferior in some ways?
But you do have to want to understand that.
You have to grasp it. But and I think, in a sense, what you both have just said is something particularly interesting, is the way in which these feelings came to us in the last decades as both truth and ridiculous. It came forth in both forms at the same time, and people both accepted it, but also, and this is something, might be something unique to the Australian psyche, laughed it off. And I'll give you a couple of examples. I mean, this idea that we live in a borderless country is absolutely true, but at the same time, no one has perhaps become as obsessed with border control. And at around about that time, I was on holiday in Port Douglas, and we drove north a little bit and found this beautiful little beach, and found this little rocky section. And I walked out to the end of this little rocky pier, this artificial pier made of local rocks, and someone had bothered to get a huge steel pole and come with a big bag of concrete and plant this pole at the end of this pier and put up a sign that said, "Watch out for illegals." And it had this map of Australia with an eye in the middle of it. And I thought, what fisherman is going to bother? And who is coming to this particular point? And who needs to be reminded?
The clear and present danger in
the clear and present danger north of Port Douglas, about 40 kilometres north of Port Douglas. This was the landing point that was identified. And I sat there and laughed about this, but at the same time saw it as one of the truths of us, you know, that we have this obsession and this anxiety. But I also think one of the things, the uniquely interesting things about Australia is that its capacity to have that and ignore it. And that has a danger side as well, because as a consequence, in the
because
name...
Because we don't interrogate it enough.
Yeah, we don't interrogate it, but we also have it and we don't accept its truth either, but we don't accept its reality perhaps, the impact that it's had on...
And also we don't own it. We don't exactly own them as being a little bit inside all of us.
Well, I think right now we have this issue, you know, that we think we need to send the message, right? The government says we need to send the message. And the way in which they're sending the message is by literally doing harm to other people's lives, making an example of other people who are, in all reality, innocent. And they know that, in all probability, these people are innocent and deserving of help. But they feel the obligation to send a message, and that message is being sent through the body of these people and the families and the psyches of these people. And this is the part of us that is indifferent to harm.
You're listening to Creative Instinct with me, Michael Sheriffs, and I'm speaking to artist and performer David Pledger and cultural theorist Nikos Papastagiadis about the impact on all of us of Australia's continuing culture of using refugees as political messages. Nikos, you talk about our indifference to harm. Where does that indifference come from?
I think there's a fragility at the moment in terms of our sense of comfort. Everybody wants to be comfortable and prosperous and productive and efficient and looking like they're doing the right thing. But no one knows what the real achievement is for those things, what the goal to say, okay, I've achieved X, I'm now comfortable in myself as a professional. I'm comfortable in myself as a sort of provider of my family. I'm comfortable in myself as a leader in my field. And as a consequence, there's a nervousness in all fields. whether you work in the cultural sector or you're working in any business part of it, you're always, you know, people are constantly saying, I'm only as good as my next job. Mm-hmm. And that anxiety is producing a sense of, I'm too busy worrying about how I need to achieve X in order to be comfortable, and therefore I can't think about the consequences of the Y's and Z's that I'm leaving behind me.
I've pedaled this hard to get where I am. I'm not going to give it up now.
Exactly. And whether that means pushing against thinking about the consequences and the implications of what we're doing. And so we're all very fragile about our place in this country. And that, of course, has a deep history.
We're also very scared of uncovering even darker histories in the establishment of this country. And I think that if we start to sort of show an empathy, we don't know where that might end. And I think that scares us a lot.
Yes, and what I'm saying, that anxiety is multidirectional, because it's not just about our colonial history. It's also to do with our global present, to do with our sense of what it is that needs to be real, to feel that I'm on top of my game, or I'm even assured that my job will be there when I wake up tomorrow. And let's face it, the competition in the so-called global market sphere is very different to the competition when Australia was competing in itself in a kind of relatively isolated way to the rest of the world. Now there's no spaces of exemption. There are no spaces of relative isolation or splendid isolation, as the British used to think of themselves. You know, everybody is connected, and that's made people more wired, but literally more wired.
That political ambivalence that you talk about, and I think that is the issue is which has sparked the uprising in the Arab Spring. I see that there are spaces for that, an untethering, if you like, a sort of unravelling of the fabric that we have knitted together, that it is happening. I don't think it might be. I think it is happening in Australia at the moment. And that's not to be about, you know, saying, you know, let's, oh, my God, there's going to be a revolution or an uprising. I don't think that's going to happen. But I think if we address the issues that are determining the ways in which we behave and the ways in which we think about things and each other with an acuteness that we confer on issues like sport, then we will have a chance to make the best of that political ambivalence, because it's not a bad space to go through. It's a potentially an important space to go through in order to make something new. And it does not have to unravel completely, but it can just unravel a bit so that we can see our way through to making something other and better than what we have.
Particularly if we're not happy with it. I mean, part of the problem is political scientist Rahm Emani said recently that traditionally leaders would have philosophers, artists, wise people over their shoulder whispering to them. They would be moderating voices. They would be the sort of counter-arguments for potentially faulty decision-making. We don't have politicians that want to hear those voices. They've pushed the artists, the writers, the intellectuals aside.
I think there's two sides to that argument, because I think what they'll come back to you and say is, when we do a market survey in the west of Sydney, we are actually connecting with the tip of the civil voice that matters. And that is an incredibly compelling argument for people that need to look at things in bullet points on a one-pager. It's so faulty. But in order, if your objective is to maintain power in the short term, it could win you the day. So the political system is set up so that you can win the day, as opposed to leave a legacy. And that is a very different dynamic, mentally and socially.
So it's just a mathematical strategy rather than anything else. Nothing deeper than that.
But that mathematical strategy represents a contraction of the political sphere. That temporality represents a limiting of what is possible, what's expressible. And I think we just take back that early example of the Tampa. Political leaders, church leaders, legal advisors, health experts, international law experts, the cream of our civic elite, spoke out in clear, categorical, unified voice about the dangers, risks, harm, illegalities of the actions that as a society we were putting forward. That voice was unmistakable and it wasn't invisible. It was part of our discourse at the time. At the same time as those voices coming forth, we had polls, focus groups, telling the political leaders that their actions were in the right path. They were hitting a note with X and Y. And so we had this profound disconnect between the active presence of a voice, like the one you said that was conventionally whispering in the ear, being on the left shoulder of the ruler. This is a whole Enlightenment tradition of good sovereign. And at the same time, the fears and anxieties of the people being activated by X and Y. And the politicians, as David rightly described them, chose the immediate love generated by fear rather than the long-term respect generated by obligation, hope and duty.
And good leadership.
And good leadership. So was it of any great surprise that as a society we let this opportunity slip, that rather than seeing how does the reasoned voice and the fearful feeling come into dialogue, what we ended up having was people just dismissing one or the other. So the political elite, listening to the populist anxiety, were just saying, what do those people know, these so-called experts? They're disconnected from reality. They don't live in the Western suburbs. And similarly, people were saying, what these people who live in the Western suburbs don't seem to know is that we have this duty, obligation, responsibility. Of course, both sides knew each other's reality, but no one respected and was willing to participate in a sustained dialogue about how to work a way forward with both these voices as legitimate, rather than turning it into a disparaging dismissal act, because that conversation takes time. And as David said, once you've contracted the political space for conversation to a snap poll or a quick focus group
marketing exercise,
then you've already eliminated the possibility that you can have a more detailed conversation about this or let certain things sink in and take their form, which you otherwise want to push out from your consciousness.
I think if you look at the and a bit where this conversation started for me was this notion of multiculturalism being a kind of managerialist response to cosmopolitanism. I think managerialism as a mode of behaviour has created a set of questions which have been limiting and playing down to a risk-averse and fearful ecology. And actually what we need to do is we need to cast this aside, this mode of behaviour, which brings with it an inherent set of values, which has in fact revalued our society, and say, that's not going to do it. All that is going to zero point. And we need to come back to basic questions. What do we value in our daily lives? What do we value morally, socially, culturally, and spiritually? And start from there. And if anybody in that conversation says, what do I need to win the next election, just show them the door.
Well, Nikos Papastiadis and David Pledger, thank you very much for joining me on Creative Instinct today.
Thank you.
Absolute pleasure, Mike.
Artist and performer David Pledger and academic and cultural theorist Professor Nikos Papastiadis speaking to me there about our post-Tampa, post-9/11 pathologies. Nikos's new book about these collective conditions is called Cosmopolitanism and Culture. And David Pledger's art group, called Not Yet It's Difficult, has just released a set of short films called Urban and Suburban, and you can find details on our website. Thanks to John Jacobs for his help this week. I'm Michael Sheriffs. For more information, go to the website abc.net.au/Radio National and follow the links to Creative Instinct.
On the latest Common Knowledge podcast, it's all about fashion.
As the spring and summer collections are launched, the new editor of Vogue, Edwina McCann, is dropping by.
We're going to look at the way street-style photography has become so popular, it's changing the fashion industry.
And with current collections inspired by Downton Abbey and Game of Thrones, we'll look at why film and TV are influencing so many international designers.
That's Common Knowledge. You can stream or download the program from the RN website.